This is Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of Arts Us.
Don Eubanks, Associate Professor at Metropolitan State University and Cultural Consultant.
Luz Maria Frias, Executive Coach and Race Equity Strategist.
Halili, owner of the Other Media Group.
And I'm Brant Williams. I'm a correspondent at NPR News.
So as a person of color, you value those moments where you can just get away and get into things. And a lot of us like to go see a sports game, go online and play video games, and all these different things that we do for fun. However, because we are people of color in the United States, and especially during this time, going to those spaces are still times where you're going to encounter racist language, racist comments, racist dress, and all of its different forms. So today we're going to be talking about anonymous racism, the kinds of things that you encounter when nobody can see you, or you can hide behind a moniker, or be in part of a group. Many of the sports teams that have gone to play different places and have had groups of folks in that kind of group anonymity start to chant things that made it very uncomfortable for the folks who were playing. What's coming up for y'all around this anonymous racist experience that people of color have?
So, you know, one of the things that just recently happened is that there was a girl soccer players from Como Park Senior High School were the targets of racial slurs during a playoff loss to Matamida High School, according to, some of the parents that were attending that game. Some of the things that were said, they would call them like Asian food names and things like that. And then also some of the players were told to go back to the countries that they were from. And so these things were taunted out to the players at Como.
And to be fair, most of them are probably from here.
Born here.
Yeah.
Well, they probably were all born here.
Growing up, I played in high school and then went to the games of friends and things like that, even afterwards, and family members. And I smile only to mask the fact that this isn't new.
Right.
So this is getting into the news. But this is something that we were prepared for. I remember being in meeting, going to play in certain places, and the coaches being like, look, you are going to hear this. You are going to encounter this. Keep your head, or you're going to be running hills all week next week until you throw up. Because, you know,
and excuse me, I don't know the name of this player. He's African-American. I think the only one that plays in the National Hockey League, right?
Oh, yes.
And There's three
of them. Yeah. But this dude, the article was pointing out that this guy needed escort to and from the stadium because of the racism he experiences playing hockey. And for me, that's a personal tie, much like you. I grew up playing hockey, and I played hockey in the Minneapolis School League, in the Park League, but I played all the way up until my sophomore year in high school. And I'm really going to age myself, and that happened in 1969-70. I played for Minneapolis North on a sophomore team, and at the end of that year, I quit hockey. I never played it again because of all the racism that I experienced that year from fellow players that we played against, from the coaches of the teams that we played against, and from the refs.
Don, did you get a sense that maybe you presented some type of threat to these other,
when
you know, white players?
When you're 15 years old, you know, you're not thinking that you're presenting a threat to anybody. I was enjoying a sport that I excelled at. I loved playing the game. But the racism, the racist taunts, the name calling, it blew me away. I mean, it was every team we competed against, I had to deal with that. And so when I would go to my coach and kind of complain and tell him, you know, there wasn't much he could do about it, right?
And, who knows who in the crowd is being the one saying stuff.
Exactly. You know, and is it because it's a white sport? At that time, when you're that age, you're not looking at sports yet. Hockey tends to be pretty white. But should that prevent us from being able to take part?
Well, and Don, to your point that the racism isn't only by visiting teams or people in the audience. There's a recent occurrence just a couple weeks ago, so mid-October, where there were three coaches from St. Augustine High School football team in New Orleans who were all dismissed because they actually were leading a chant with the N-word to encourage their players.
To encourage?
Yeah, that was a chant that they were using to really kind of hype people up to get them ready to go out on the field.
Were these black guys?
The coaches were not. The chant was, "All I got is two pads, two hands, knock a N-word, and then another swear word, and then loose."
Read it as it is, so I understand what it is.
Yeah, that's not in my vocabulary. I just can't. I'm sorry.
Give it to Brant.
So it goes beyond the visiting team or people in the audience. I mean, the fact that you would have coaches actually using this chant to motivate and bring their kids ready to go, it makes no sense.
Oh, okay. So the quote is, "All I got is two pads, two hands, knocking N-words, S-H-T loose." Can you spell it on the radio too? So part of my challenge is, I'm not trying to perpetuate, I just want you to know the context so we can have heard it here. Mm-hmm. But there's an element of group speak that this makes me think of coming up. And that is, when you get crowds together, right? People say some pretty crazy stuff in the competition space, on the field, on the court and stuff. So I have absolutely heard some pretty mean and rough stuff said to the folks on the court. What is interesting to me in terms of a pattern that we've talked about all around is, in that group and in that crowd, while you're saying those things, racial epithets also become something that you can lob at folks. And in this particular case, it's something that you can lob at folks of color on the court, and there's no comeback, right? I remember being at a game, and we were way out. And I remember that folks weren't chanting stuff that was overtly racist in the game, but they were saying things like, you know, somebody would make it, and we'd say, "Count it," right? Because we'd make the shot, "Count it." And so folks thought it would be funny that when we start to make shots after that, they'd go, "Welfare check. Welfare check," and you'd hear things like, you know, you'd be taking a free throw and somebody's yelling "single mom" or things like that that are just dog whistle things. And you look up and you want to go point somebody out, you know. Right now, it wasn't coming from players in the court because I have proximity to you,
right?
Right, mm-hmm. I can see you, mm-hmm. But in a group, in a crowd, there's another level of anonymity that comes in there, where even folks feel emboldened as a group to yell something. Or, Don, as you had mentioned, the tomahawk chop that happens even in professional sports, right? That we feel comfortable as a group doing this, but where one-on-one or in a space that's where I can be singled out or somebody can point and say, "You did X, Y, and Z," and it's not a group, I don't feel as comfortable doing it.
So the other thought that came to mind was September of 2019, where an Ohio high school football team were subjected to racist chants and Confederate flags. So they were being subjected to chants using the N-word and Confederate flags. And then in that same game, a group of people saying "white power" and 1, 2, 3, "white power," and chanting that. And then you've got students reporting that not only were they feeling the fear there, but also that precluded them from feeling safe enough to go to the restroom all by themselves. So, you know, the dynamics become even more intense when we're looking at this from that group dynamics and the fact that they feel that chanting this is okay and acceptable.
Luz, you know what I wonder about when these things happen, especially when it comes to like high schools? I remember when I was in high school that there was always the kind of guys who like to get a rise out of people. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this is another instance of like white privilege, of young white males who realize that they have this power over people of color and that they can say things to them and, you know, push their buttons and they can provoke you to or strike fear or that sort of thing into people of color, especially in like these group events. You've got a group of young white guys who, I'm guessing at some of these sporting events, were the ones leading these chants, doing it to maybe because not necessarily that they were prepared to commit violence against these people, but wanted to scare them and just want to say, "Hey, look, we have power over you."
They get away with it because boys will be boys, right?
Yeah,
when you're young and you're at a sporting event, that's what
I think it goes beyond sporting events. I mean, how many of us have ever walked down the street and had a car full of young white males drive by you And then the window gets rolled down.
And somebody yells, go back to Africa. I've been hit in the head with a milkshake driving next to a car full of folks, just like you described. I've been on a street and had – and somebody threw a freaking – the retainer, the thing that you pop in and take out. You know, I've had things yelled, you know, going down the street. Also, too, you know, fear isn't necessarily the thing that comes to mind. On a court, if I can get you upset and frustrated, I'm doing something great for my other team. It's the same reason why we yell at the game now. We go to Lynx games, right? We yell when the other team is shooting a free throw, right?
Right.
We're trying to get you to stop focusing on what's happening here. Right. And in that case, you're not going to yell an epithet. One, at my Lynx team, just know that if you in my vicinity at a Lynx game and you start popping off like that, I'm going to take care of it.
Right.
Than somebody else. But there's an element that I can get you off your game in this way and get you riled up.
Right. But there are other ways of doing that than yelling racist slurs at them.
Then there's a sense of normalcy that begins to be attached to that behavior that it extends beyond the scope of the game, right? In the auditorium. And Anthony, you're talking about how you've had things thrown and yelled at you. My oldest daughter, when she was a senior in high school, which is not that long ago, she was at a bus stop across the street from a high school that she had done some diving. She was on the diving team. Mid-afternoon, it was 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the afternoon, the only one at the bus stop, and a car full of four white young men rolled down the window and yelled the N-word to her. And she, of course, is fearing for her safety at that point. 2:30 in the afternoon, the only one at the bus stop, and she calls me in a panic. And I'm in another city. I can't help her. And begin to coach her as to what she needs to do to find safety for herself, because you've got a car full of young men yelling at her in this fashion.
When we were talking about like being afraid to walk to the bathroom or like what you're saying, then Don said it wasn't fear that you felt. Maybe it's a woman thing.
It's a gender.
Yeah. When I'm at places and I hear racial slurs called out at me, when I have to go to the restroom, I make someone go with me. I immediately feel a threat.
Well, you think about the different examples and what we've seen on social media with videos of threatening behavior that involves racial epithets that escalates really quickly. The one that comes to mind was a video I saw in the last week or so in New York, taking the train. A white woman is verbally assaulting an Asian passenger. What they can link it to is it was set off by the fact that the Asian passenger bumped into the white woman passenger by accident. And the way it's New York, right?
Yeah, you're going to.
And she started hurling racial slurs at the Asian passenger and then became physically violent and started hitting her with an umbrella and hitting her with keys and then spitting at her and then kicking her. And then other passengers intervened and created a safety zone between the two. And then actually one passenger, a Latino, basically corralled this white passenger and wouldn't let her leave until police came and were able to arrest her. And the other passengers then provided safety for that Latino passenger to allow that. Then he was safe and clear from the police, you know, in terms of any misgivings that the police may have had and seeing this upon arrival. But yeah, I mean, fear is real. For me, I know when I hear racial epithets in public, I don't know what to expect.
As a black male, if I go into a space, like particularly a place where there's alcohol and lots of testosterone, if I hear a yeehaw, I get a little nervous. I'm surveying the landscape a little closer.
It puts your alert button on.
Right. I have that radar that kind of goes up. And I don't know if everybody has that, but I feel it sometimes.
I was just going to go there. You know, Hlee, you talked about wondering if it's a gender thing. I definitely have stories where things, you know, turn darker. You know, at a sports game, you know, folks dip into this racist arsenal to try to get a rise out of the folks in the court. I'm not necessarily feeling fear in that space. But I have been exactly the places you describe. And I've had wonderful times outstate Minnesota, you know, with people who are treating me sweetly. And it's awesome. But then, you know, and so when it's good, it's really, really, really good. When it's bad, it's been very, 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 very bad. I have definitely been in places where that whoop goes up, the alert goes up, and you're like, mm-hmm. uh-oh, there's this comfortability with being a little bit more overtly racist in those spaces. And I've had, you know, folks get up and said, all right, and you were very clearly outnumbered, and I've had to back out,
yeah,
walk out, because I'm just not the guy that's going to take on the whole bar. Mm-hmm. I have friends who are, and I got to make sure that we don't go to those places together, you know, and so... There's this element of the group mm-hmm. that is part of a lot of this. Very rarely have I experienced it one-on-one.
Kind of that mob mentality.
But when there's a group, mm-hmm. that means, you know, I might not get singled out by myself.
But so, where it gets worse is when it's sanctioned. I love watching football, right? But I cannot stand watching teams that still have Native American mascots.
Right.
The Redskins, the Chiefs.
Right.
Blackhawks.
That's hockey,
mm-hmm. but still. Mm-hmm.
But the Braves, right? And so when that team does something particularly well, the fans start this mock kind of thing with this tomahawk chop thing, and it just drives me nuts. And you talk about a group thing. I mean, and that's part of
Yeah, and
of
it seems
their...
like everybody's doing it. I was watching the Green Bay Packers were playing the Kansas City Chiefs not too long ago. And I'm anti-Green Bay Packers. Anybody who knows me knows that. You know, I'm a Vikings fan. When I see the Packers playing, I'm pulling for anybody who's playing the Green Bay Packers.
Yes.
But I tell you, when I see Kansas City Chiefs fans like doing the chop, I'm just like...
I can't even watch home games like when we go to Washington to play Washington because I know someone's going to show up in headgear and right. be in, you know, and face paint and be in the crowd in the background. And so that even like, I'm glad that Washington came here at least so that we didn't have to see
that. So, Don, yes. I think maybe for listeners who are wondering, why do you have that visceral response? Can you enlighten our listeners?
It's because... when we as a community have asked these teams to change their mascots, to change these motifs, these practices, we are constantly told by the owners of these teams and by their fan base that they do these things to honor us, that they're honoring us. I mean, just think about the psychology of that. How does the term Redskin honor us? Here in the state of Minnesota, after the Dakota War, right? I won't get into the whole reason.
We can go deep in history.
That would be a whole show. But one of the results of that is there was an effort to clean up Indians that were still Dakota and others, including my folks, that were still in the state of Minnesota. So the state and different counties issued a flyer for a bounty to bring in a redskin, meaning that you could scalp the Indian instead of bringing in the whole. But the term was used in a derogatory manner to explain, and I believe the price was $200. And the comment was, that was too much.
So I actually have a poster. So it was on flyers like that, but there was also in county ticket that were giving information on who to vote for. And I have a poster that was put out by the Minnesota State Governor. This is under Governor Ramsey, right? And so we already get problematic in school and we want to go to the Ramsey Hill House and venerate this governor of Minnesota's history. Well, if you're native, you might as well put Ramsey's picture up on the wall next to Andrew Jackson because it was not a good thing. In the bottom is a quote and it says, the state reward for dead Indians has increased to $200.
Yes.
This is more than the sum of all the Indians east of the Red River are worth. And
that's
so
was the quote.
And so we have.
So how are they honoring?
Exactly. I mean, but that is the story we're always told.
That and like, oh, it's tradition. It's been like that for 30 years. Therefore, it's going to be like that forever.
Let's be clear. The term, which and understand that I can use Redskins, but N-word would be bleeped out in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the word has always been a racial epithet. Mm-hmm. There's never been a time when it's not. Right. Mm-hmm. And just last Thursday, you know, I was speaking at the Asada Speaks event over at Brave New Workshop. A group from Indigenous Roots had been at the protest, which were really neat and confined, right, to try to make it, you know, so that, all right, you can do your protest and we can play a football game and then everybody's happy kind of setup. Right. And the fatigue that came back, because folks have been screaming blue until they're blue in the face about the fact that you're putting this in my face over and over again, and we are, to your point, sanctioning it. We are also sanctioning this behavior when, unlike unruly chants, like if you were to scream curse words down at the basketball court, they may make your team forfeit. Mm-hmm. However, I have seen a lot less consequence for folks who are shouting racial epithets. Oh, you just sit down. Stop being so rowdy. All those kinds
on
of things.
On a high school level and across the board, there have not been any repercussions from the community or the schools of the incidences that happened.
Yeah, like
with
Mata Mirai, their comment was, we're looking into it. And I mean, if you think about like social media, how many people shared that story right from the city pages about the Mata Mirai Como? And let's just recognize that Mata Mirai is not a white person word in itself, right?
Right, that came from an indigenous culture.
Exactly. And then everybody else was sharing, or both people were sharing the story of the Jordan soccer team where a player's hijab had fallen off and the opposing team surrounded her so that she could have privacy to fix her hijab while they're in the middle of a match.
That was powerful.
That was powerful.
And so I was like, okay, so we just had this thing happen.
Yes.
And then we have this other thing happen. And do people not notice that they're like the opposite of each other?
Totally opposite. Right.
And that it's not that hard. Like, it's not that difficult to be culturally sensitive and aware. And when we're talking about how these actions continue to occur and they're sanctioned, I mean, they're falling on deaf ears. And that's why people are protesting. That's why we're having these conversations on our podcast. And that's why social media is critical, is there's a continuous need to have these voices heard and these issues elevated so that, ultimately speaking, we can have change.
Well, Luz, what do you think is causing the resistance to, as Don was saying, is people protest about these team names and the owners will say, well, we mean that as to honor your people and we don't mean to be offensive. What is your thought about why this resistance? To changing these?
I think, like most often, says follow the money, right? Mm-hmm. These teams have built a brand around that. They have brand loyalty. They have a following. And to completely change the name might result in having financial losses on a larger scale and losing a certain segment of their followers. I think it's a business decision, like many other decisions that we continue to see, where people are validating those acts irrespective of what the people are saying, what we want.
As we talk about patterns, right, you think these are times for us to finally be able to let hair down and enjoy. And it's yet another example where folks of color don't get to put that guard down, that alert button gets popped up in places that folks deem as normal. There's very seldom a space outside of your own home that you get to be light and get to enjoy just something that's always there. I'm reminded of this because I was outside of the Como Water Park. Right across is the McMurray Field. Folks playing soccer tournaments, folks doing soccer practice, folks just playing soccer in that space. And it tends to be Latinx, Somali, and Hmong. Folks who play soccer there quite a bit. And you'll sit there and you'll feel like, oh, this is great. You know, this is a great thing to see in the middle of the same neighborhood where the team is from, that, you know. However, I got folks coming out the water park talking about, ooh, ice could really make a killing coming up to this field. And you hear that out of people right there, right? So it doesn't seem to be a place, and especially if it's group. The difference is they didn't think that they said it loud enough for me to hear. So I turn around, and they must not have seen me standing there close. And I said, hey, what is that you just said about ice? And all of a sudden, they hurry up and get into the car and stuff like that. And I'm walking over like, hey, I just want to know what you just said about ice. Because, you know, this is my neighborhood. Like, ice don't have a stomach for that. We're going to have this conversation right then and there, right? They hurry up, skirt out, pull off, right? And here's St. Paul Police coming up and, you know, asking me if there's an issue. It's those kinds of things that we see with this group speak.
And I want to respond to your question too, Brandt, is the show The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt a few years ago had a storyline. Within their storyline was that they found out that the NFL made so much money from people buying Redskin jerseys and then burning them that they decided to change the name of their team to the Washington Gun Takers. And so much money came from people actually going out, purchasing all this stuff so they could burn it as a protest.
Well, this is Counter Stories. We're having a discussion today about anonymous racism, people in crowds and sporting events saying all kinds of racist chants and everything. We're going to continue our conversation after a little bit of news. Welcome back to Counter Stories. I'm Brant Williams. I'm here with Holly Lee, Anthony Galloway, Don Eubanks, and Luz Maria Frias. We've been talking about anonymous racism, and we're going to keep the conversation going. I think Lee had another topic to explore.
Another thing that was in the headlines lately was the young woman who was wearing a hijab who was disqualified from a race.
Oh, yes.
This also happened in Ohio. And before the race, the officials had gone around to inspect everyone, said nothing to her about her hijab, actually told one of her running mates that they were wearing the wrong kind of shorts or something, and she had to change.
Right.
And then so the girl runs the race, and after she finishes, then they tell her, you can't wear the hijab. So it's like this racism, when we talk about racism in sports, and I know we're also talking about anonymity, but it happens on such a high level. Right? Who's making these rules?
Well, and that to me still speaks to this space of anonymity, right? Let me define the term a little bit.
Because it would be anonymous until it hits social media.
It's the people who are making the rules are making these rules behind closed doors,
and
right?
That's exactly the anonymity that I'm thinking about in that case. If I can hide behind a policy, I can hide behind the vagueness of something. Mm-hmm. I never have to take an individual stand, right? If it was a situation where that decision would have gone back to an individual person, I bet you any amount of money that decision wouldn't have been made the same way.
If there was a decision maker who had to say yes or no on it.
If there can be a veil in front of me and the outward expression of whatever that belief is, then it's much more comfortable making that. Anonymity happens in groups, but it also happens online and in spaces where I can't see your face or know your name. Hmm. And one of the areas I encounter it often is gaming. Now, I find this just absolutely hilarious, Don, that you play Call of Duty.
Yes.
Like that makes my heart sing as a black nerd. What's been your experience playing online?
I was thinking about that. I haven't played it like in the past 2 months. But my son introduced me to that game, and I got hooked. I loved it because it allowed me to relax. But, when you play these games or other types of games, you kind of make up a name for yourself, right? And my name was tied to my identity as a Native American person. Mm-hmm. When you would go on the game, your name shows up on a board, right? Up to 12 people can play, and then the computer will split that up into two groups of six, and then you play against one another. My name popped up on the board, and immediately, because you can wear earphones and a speaker, a mic, and people talk and converse. I don't, but they do. Soon as my name showed up, somebody said, oh, look, a wagon burner just joined us. It happened so quick that my immediate thought was, dang, this person was quick, because that's a witty response. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, it was within a millisecond that this comment came out, then the anger set in, because... What the hell do you mean? A wagon burger?
What's the name you use again?
A Native American motif, right?
Right.
I was using a term of Ojibwe with some letters and numbers.
Right.
The fact that this person recognized that as a Native American term, but the fact that the response was like instantaneous. Hmm. Oh, we got a wagon burner with us.
And Xbox racist has been a thing in community you talk about.
I was on PS3.
Oh, you're on PS3.
Okay. Yeah.
Online gaming racist, our president just recently referred to the whole impeachment process as lynching. That same night, playing online, folks began to use that where, you're killing each other. So there is something to be explored about why mm-hmm. it's relaxing to sit back and have cartoon characters and blow each other to bits.
Yes, exactly.
But, so that's a thing. I take it. We could go down that conversation. But I remember getting blown up by a grenade and somebody say, oh, you lynched him. And I'm like, okay.
No, you
that's,
didn't.
That's okay. So now I'm sitting there going, I can address this here, but it won't do anything. They don't know what they're talking about. And because they don't know them, because they're anonymous, right? I can say things. That's not even the worst thing that gets, and most racist thing that gets said when you're playing online with folks. And sometimes, you know, me and a group of friends, we'll get to playing and we'll find a group of really particular racist folks and we'll figure out a way to keep rematching these cats to just obliterate them in the game because that's the only thing that you can do.
So what you're talking about is the normalization of that word lynching so that other people become desensitized to what lynching actually was.
We saw this happen when people were calling the tent cities concentration camps. Mm-hmm. Right? So we saw this happen before as well.
Yeah, that language gets played out, and especially if I have a veil, going back to that anonymity thing. Then I get to practice using in all these different things. And since that was uttered, it wasn't just that gaming experience. I got youth who are coming back and are having to deal with it and hear it come back up in their school experiences online and their school experiences on notes that are passed through that are scribbled on bathroom walls. Keeps going. And again, when we sanction it by not addressing it and calling it out as inappropriate.
My brother used to, when he was younger, he probably still doesn't. I just don't know because we don't live together anymore. But he would play these games online with other people. Mm-hmm. And I walked in one day and I heard just the most horrific things. And I said, who are you talking to? And he's like, oh, they're my teammates. I'm like, they're calling you Chink, you know, they're saying all this stuff about you. And he's like, no, but they're on my team. You know, like we're killing the other people. And I was like, I just don't think this is appropriate. And he was like, oh, I just ignore it. You know, whatever. They're just people on the internet. Wow. And I remember thinking, if he didn't have me to talk with him about it, would he then just start going to school and repeating what he hears on these video games?
Or internalizing it. I mean, the damage that's done to our youth and to our collective people with that type of language, and you begin to internalize it. So the fact that you pointed that out to him, I think, was a healthy step, at least for him, because, you know, the oppression that subpopulate communities of color, American Indians feel. You know, one of the things that research has done about is that folks will start to internalize some of these messages and begin to believe that.
And I think that's why when we were talking about why we sanction it is because a lot of people of color are just like, oh, yeah, again, or I'm used to it, you know, or it's. And there's not like you said, there's nothing you can do. They're online. They're saying this stuff. So all you can do is beat them.
Yeah, I can report you to Xbox, but your gamer tag ain't going nowhere.
You know, we can't lose sight of the fact that young children, 8, 9 year olds, are playing these video games. And
With other 8 and 9 year olds.
And
too.
To have them exposed to this language and exposed to that type of, you know, racist behavior and animosity is something that we all as adults should be concerned about.
So here's the interesting piece, because you're going to play with 12-year-olds if you're playing online. Like, all of a sudden, when you're talking about, you can hear in the voice, unless somebody just has a voice, you know, there's a reference to George Washington Carver in there somewhere. Because George Washington Carver was castrated as a young person, so he's an old man with the voice of a 12-year-old. And this is the exact response I gave to somebody who had to be young. I don't know what age he was, right? But he was a young kid, and he was like, ooh, I just chopped your stuff off. First and foremost, it was affected. So an urban speak done by for somebody who's very specifically not from the inner city. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to put this affecting voice on. I said, you ain't got to talk like that, man. You ain't from the hood. No, you ain't got to talk about the hood. We cool. We had this conversation going back and forth, right? And then when he said that, I was like, man, you don't want to say that to a black man. You ever heard about George Washington Carver? And like I'm actually having a conversation because that's just, I'm that guy.
You're that guy online.
And so he's like, okay. And I tell him the story about George Washington Carver. He was like, I never knew that. All right, but we're going to go and blow this thing up over here. So that was the extent of it. Right.
But that's important, that interaction you had with him.
There was behavior change after calling it out. Mm-hmm. But where the behavior change doesn't happen is the majority of the time I encounter racists that are not 12 years old. It's not young folks.
Right.
It's folks who are older, who should know better and all. That's who I encounter as Xbox racists.
And that's the people playing video games online is a huge, huge number of people. You know, when everybody has an iPad, everybody has a computer, a laptop. And so, you know, it's being sure that you're vigilant of what your children are doing. But like you said, it's hard when it's the adults.
I've had to extend this because there's the gaming portion of that I have to worry about for my children. But then there's also just the online anonymity space If I can post something without having it be, we've experienced this. Brand, well, I know as a journalist, you experience this in comment sections of news stories all the time.
Yeah, I don't read them anymore.
Right, right.
I was gonna say, and that's been a huge problem over the, you know, the last decade at least, where there are publications that have to turn off the comment section because they get so loaded with racist and vile language and just...
Look at the Cheerio, the interracial Cheerios commercial.
Oh, yeah.
That they had to do for the comment section.
Yep. Yep.
It's ridiculous.
You know, but this is interesting because I am also a member of a thing called Neighbor Next Door.
Oh, yes. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And between both Neighbor Next Door and Ring. So I installed Ring cameras after somebody stole my hoopty. Why are they going to steal the hoopty? You know, there's a Honor Amongst Thieves thing right there that's bugging
Google
me.
Google hoopty.
But I installed Ring. And I joined that community. When you do that, you join a community of folks. And the stuff that comes over these, because you can talk with other neighbors and they can share videos and say, mm-hmm. I remember I was looking at one and there was this little black boy rolling a lawnmower up the alleyway. And all the comments are about like, oh, here we go again. What's he stealing? Whose lawnmower is this? Does anybody know whose lawnmower this? Let's call it. What'd the police say? All this kind of stuff. And then buried in all of that, there's one neighbor who is like, yeah, he just got done cutting my lawn.
Mowing my lawn,
and he's
yeah.
going mm-hmm. back home. You get on there thinking, okay, mm-hmm. as a community of folks, yes. you're going to stay in touch.
Yes.
Within a day, I'm seeing the most racist, assumptive, stereotypical stuff.
I had to unsubscribe from Nextdoor because mm-hmm. I thought, what a great concept. Now my community, and we can talk about safety, you know, and things that are happening, yep. events. Right. And so I'm like, okay, subscribe to everything. Now I only subscribe to when people lose pets.
Right.
Sure.
Because I'm not interested anymore because there was just so much. Immediately, right off the bat, there was so much about even like, oh, this business is vacant. All the comments were like, I hope they don't bring no more stinky Asian food in here, you know? And so I'm like, we can't even talk about like, anything.
There are certain Twitter accounts that watch police activity when their arrests made or there's scanner activity and, mm-hmm. and police report that they've, you know, made arrests in some type of incident. And occasionally you will see posts on some of these accounts, which are, they're very particular about pointing out the race of the people who are being arrested and then chastising members of the media for not reporting that the people who were arrested were black or, you know, Asian. Mm-hmm. And like trying to throw it at the media that, you know, we're politically correct because we don't include the race of the folks that are, you know, arrested and charged in some of these. And, you know, that's becoming more and more common I'm seeing. And I think that goes along with what you're talking about, Anthony, with the next door chatter. It's always about it comes back to the race of the people who are the subjects of these particular calls, police calls.
Mm-hmm. It's the assumption that people of color don't belong. I think the idea behind it was to create community conversation, but it ends up becoming a forum. So if someone happens to look out their window and they see a person of color who lives in their neighborhood, there's this immediate assumption they don't belong. And
what it's doing, it's really, it's surfacing the truth of what our community looks like, the truth of what's going on in our country. The truth is what is going on in our neighborhood. I mean, people are showing their true selves.
Mm-hmm.
And we are protected from that and insulated from that if we only stay within our circles, right? Because we're like-minded folks and we hang out with like-minded folks, and that's what community often means. But with these new tools, it is now just shedding light on what the real dynamics are that we haven't seen, not because they didn't exist, but because we didn't have a mechanism to show it.
Right. And I should say that when it comes to reporting, because I cover a lot of crime and courts and police and that sort of thing. We've been trying to come a long way when it comes to when do we describe somebody by their racial characteristic. There's a higher bar now for doing that. And I think that just comes from, from years and years. Well, if there is somebody who is on the loose, somebody who poses a threat and police say, hey, look, you know, there's somebody who's been committing, you know, like these serial rapes or something like that. And they give a description.
Sure.
And we want to put that out there because, you know, okay, this may help somebody be safe.
Remember,
but if there's something other, but you know.
But I mean, there was.
Yeah, I mean, if that's a part of that, you know, if it's an integral part of, you know.
Or a race bias crime, maybe, or you know, race bias crime, I mean, that where sort it's of relevant. Thing.
I mean, there are instances where you, to be as descriptive as possible. There was it may include a person's racial identity.
I mean, that's what happened with Philandro, right? A black man with a wide set nose was driving around, and that was a description. I mean, I've been in situations where they said, an Asian male with spiky hair in a Toyota. And I told my brother, I was like, don't leave the house!
I would stop Northside in the Letterman's jacket because I fit a particular description. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody in a red and white Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated jacket on the Northside. There's no way that he looks like a 6'5" light-skinned dude in a blue jacket.
Right.
Which I only heard because I could overhear the radio. You know, so there's a deep sensitivity around the descriptor side. And so where do you balance, you know, where do you balance needing to be descriptive with tying into and feeding into what people want to hear in communities that have these racial mindsets?
Yes, and the amount of danger that it poses to a black man. Like yourself, Anthony, you have nothing to do with the crime, but if you are seen as fitting, quote unquote, the profile, we know what is happening to unarmed individuals by police.
Exactly.
And so that really is the issue. It's not so much that it's the danger and risk that,
that
comes
puts
to
everybody else
that,
that
comes
that
to these lives because of what's really happening in our society and the killing of unarmed civilians.
And it's not just these online applications. I mean, you know, recently I went down to Iowa City. The University of Iowa honored the 2009-2010 Hawkeye football team that won the Orange Bowl. My son was a part of that team. And so we went down there. Iowa was playing Penn State. One of my son's roommates' dad, during that period, had relocated back to North Carolina. And they lived in Charlotte. But then he moved to another community around Charlotte, North Carolina. And the day that he was physically moving into his new home, his new house, a truck had pulled up and he was beginning to carry stuff into the house. And then all of a sudden, the police show up and the police begin to question him. And apparently one of his neighbors saw he's African-American, saw him moving into this very nice neighborhood, and police were there for a half hour. He had to invite them into the house. He had to explain the stuff that he had to go through this whole explanation. You know what the police's response to him was? Go meet your neighbors.
We got that too. We got that too at my parents' house. They built these new developments and people were complaining there were too many cars at my parents' house all the time. To be fair, we don't all live there. It's just my mom, my dad, my grandma, and my little brother when he's around. We go there a lot on the weekends, you know, and we do a lot of stuff. And so there was all this complaining to the point where, like, the city came out and, like, wrote my dad a letter about how, you know, he had to maintain his driveway a certain way and the neighbors keep complaining. And so it must have come from the new development because my parents have lived there for 10 years. Nobody ever complained. The new development came in across the street. And now we're getting all these cops called on us all the time. And they're like, just go meet your neighbors.
Let's
settle the families with the burden rather than having the other folks become more enlightened about the fact that there is no problem.
Right.
These are homeowners and they have a right to move into their house. They have a right to see their children on the weekend and have these cars parked.
I want to link all these together because whether we're talking about the group dynamics and feeling safe enough to do these things in a group or the anonymity of being online and being able to be anonymous in that space and be able to say these things.
Or look out your window.
Or to look out a window. As long as there is a veil before me and people of color are experiencing, when that veil goes up, so too comes all the racial mindsets that in a public space may seem like they're going away. I have had many folks that have talked to me about, oh, well, that's just online. That's just trolls online. That's just this and that. But you see the net result of those patterns keep things alive that should be dying and are not. All you have to do is put that veil up and all what's done in the dark, right? And I think it's important to call out, as you called out, Luz, that there is a net action, a behavior that happens as a result of being able to be anonymously racist. Okay. What are some of the things that you do when you encounter those things?
I think that's the question really for all of us to wrestle with and not just people of color.
Absolutely.
And I would say it's really incumbent upon non-people of color, so Caucasian folks, to really understand these issues and step up and understand that it is as much their responsibility and even more so to come to the table and to hold folks accountable. And it's when we begin to have and create this collective understanding that the way this goes away and the way that we can change it is by all of us agreeing that it's important to do that.
I think, like, for me, I used to try to, like, hey, you know, maybe you should read this article or learn about this or, you know, enlighten yourself or learn about the situation before you comment.
You mean like racism for dummies?
Is there something like that?
We make millions on that one.
I believe I have seen that. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Especially online. And because I do a lot of work in different communities, I belong to like different community Facebook groups and stuff. But now I'm probably part of the problem, Luz, like you're saying that we should all say something, because now I just ignore it because it's so hard to explain to people that, you know, just because Melvin Carter is black isn't why we have bad trash arrangements.
Oh, do you know what I mean? Heard that.
I mean, it's just like, it's like, wow. Almost gets to the point to me where now I'm just like, I don't think this person understands logic or reason, and I'm exhausted.
And I think that, because I know we're wrapping this up, but, you know, also in those spaces when we're not around, because it is that time of year, right? And so how many people are going to show up at their parties in blackface, right? Or how many are going to show up with, you know, Native American headdress?
A couple who got kicked out of a restaurant because they came as Native Americans and they were so mad. They felt like it was racism. We're like, oh, yeah, hello, now you know. Oh, my gosh.
Well, we have Dia de los Muertos, which falls within the same time frame, October 31st to November 2nd. There's an increased proliferation of folks painting their face.
Oh, yeah, especially with the movies that had come with on the last year.
Catrinas and stuff, where they're missing the entire point that for us, Dia de los Muertos, which translates into Day of the Dead, it is to honor those loved ones who have passed away, and we're trying to connect with them in the afterworld and bring them back into the family with the notion that if we continue to remember them and pay homage in that way every year, they're never gone. But instead, you have folks now dressing up and trying to look like it's part of the Dia de los Muertos as a Halloween costume. And that's not okay, folks. It is not.
No matter where you go, and this is the unfortunate reality of it, and it feel like it happens the moment when your guard is down the most. I remember being in the hospital. My daughter didn't wake up at school, off the school bus, and they had to call the ambulance. I got there. I had to ride over, and it took them a long time to get her to wake up. She just would not come out of her sleep. And they finally got her up, and we immediately had to go to the neurologist and figure out why my daughter didn't wake up. And I'm at the hospital, and the guy is beginning to put in the leads. And he begins to go, one little, two little, three little.
Are you serious?
And I am thinking that this is just a space where everybody is committed to the health of my daughter. And now in addition to being committed to the health of my daughter, I have to turn around and figure out, one, how to encapsulate her from a mentality that's there, to also challenge the person who is doing it, and then to make sure that the hospital knows that that's not okay. He was completely ignorant of the true meaning of that song. That's the kind of thing that happens when we allow and we sanction by our silence the things that we need to be calling out and educating on. And so, you know, I just want us to think about that fact. As long as there's a veil and we don't encounter the stuff that happens behind that veil, we allow for us to continue to be in spaces where we should be able to be the most vulnerable and yet are still faced by the effects of racism. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of Arts Us.
Don Eubanks, Associate Professor, Metropolitan State University and Cultural Consultant.
Luz Maria Frias, Executive Coach and Race Equity Strategist.
Lee Lee, owner of The Other Media Group.
And Brant Williams, Correspondent at NPR News.
This is Counter Stories.